This is the Youth Worker Collective podcast from Young People's Ministries. You don't have to be in ministry alone with resources, coaching, games, and more at umcyoungpeople.com.
Hi there, everybody. I hope you are having an excellent Monday. Today, you just get me, Chris, hanging out with you. Jeremy is enjoying a day off with his children being off from school. So you just get to hear me talk for a little while on the Youth Worker Recharge for today. The topic that I'm going to tackle actually is going to be something like a brief history of adolescence. And what you're going to hear from me are actually a couple of pieces that I use in trainings and workshops that I do in different parts of the country and different parts of the connection whenever I get invited to be able to kind of join in trainings and other pieces like that. So what I'm going to do is actually end up doing a little bit of screen sharing with you because I want to make sure that if you are leading young people's ministries, you've got, well, I guess a little bit of grounding for where the idea of adolescence or where the idea of teenage years came from once upon a time. So I'm going to attempt to do a little bit of screen sharing. You'll only see two or three different slides, but I'm basically going to start talking very quickly, keep my foot on the gas pedal, and hopefully this will be somewhat informative, even if it's not all that entertaining. So, all right, here we go. You should be seeing a slide that says a brief history of adolescence. Here we go. This is super duper brief. This would be even less than a 101 kind of a level overview. But again, I don't have that much time and you don't have that much time either. So here we go. Okay. The Industrial Revolution is taking place in the late 1800s. Prior to the 1800s, in most of Europe, in most of the Americas, in the places that we would consider developed into first world countries at this point, really were still mostly agricultural. And being agricultural meant that you and your family lived and worked on a farm, unless you were in a very privileged and wealthy position. If you were part of a family that lived and worked on a farm, it meant that, well, you were born and, well, childhood meant a lot of working, okay? It meant parents having kids that would stay home on the farm. And because they were at home on the farm, that meant free labor for the parents that were trying to do everything that they could possibly do to be able to sustain their lives and make sure that their children grew up healthy. It didn't mean a lot of education opportunities because you were born and expected to be able to work. There was really a direct transition from childhood to adulthood, okay? There wasn't this recognition of the teenage years or any kind of liminal space where you were a teenager, right? You were either a child who was under the care of your parents, or you were considered an adult and making adult decisions and needing to figure out how to make your own way in life. As part of this time, when the Industrial Revolution starts to hit, it actually kind of upends what looks like this very normal social order. And you see a lot of people moving from the country to city centers because that's where factories were based. As factories started to get built up in the Industrial Revolution, it provided other work opportunities. And young people started to look for those opportunities and go to work in factories instead of always staying at home to work on the family farm. Okay. As the Industrial Revolution starts to spread, factory jobs continue to grow. Children continue to work in those factories and honestly don't get paid very well. They get paid a lot less than the adults working those same factory jobs would have been getting paid. Although at the time, listen, most of those workers in the factories were not getting paid very well either. So any conversations about living wages or those kinds of things and the growth of unions out of the Industrial Revolution are really important to be able to have because people are trying to figure out how to make a better life for themselves. And, you know, having these factory jobs created some new opportunities. So big movement of people from country to city centers for the sake of being able to work in factories. As the Industrial Revolution gets set, along came somebody whose nickname is the father of adolescence or the grandfather of adolescence, and that is G. Stanley Hall. G. Stanley Hall does a lot of research on younger people and introduces the idea of adolescence in 1883 before actually coining the term itself in 1904. When he originally coins the term adolescence, he is talking about the years of 12, 13, and 14 years of age. Prior to being 12, you would have been considered a child. After 14, you would have been considered an adult. His ideas related to adolescence continue to influence developmental studies and educational theory all the way into today. And he was really the first person that sort of in an official and academic way identified this liminal space that is somewhere between childhood and adulthood. Okay. I think we would all agree that today we would assume that definition of adolescence is, or at least that age range of adolescence is a little bit short. There is no way that we would consider somebody who has just completed their 14th birthday a full-on adult in most of the cultures that we are a part of. Okay. Continuing on. Adolescence really hits the mainstream and people start to understand this idea of the teenage years in the early 1900s. World War I starts to happen. And after World War I comes in the United States, especially the Great Depression. Okay. Towards the middle and the end of the Great Depression, child labor laws start to get introduced and adopted across the United States. So specifically within a U.S. setting here, you're finding that children at the time, right, in the 19-teens, 20s, and 30s, in part because of people going to adults going to serve in war, but also the growing economy and the demands placed on workers, that children make up a significant percentage of factory work at pretty low wages. When child labor laws get introduced, it opens the door for public education to become a standard and very accessible across every economic level that might have been available in the United States at the time. It's one of the first places where the idea of letting kids be kids starts to take root. And prior to this, the average educational level in the United States was something like a sixth grade education level. Okay. Because the child labor laws get passed, public education gets reformed and made accessible for everyone, the expectation eventually grows into the understanding that getting a high school diploma or graduating from high school is the expectation level for what you need to succeed in terms of your education, as opposed to being able to succeed as an adult with a sixth grade level of education. Okay. This longer education period starts to extend the age of adolescence all the way up to the age of 18 in the 1940s and 50s. Okay. In the 40s, of course, the U.S. starts to get involved with World War II, and military service starts to expand kind of the window that carries into young adulthood, with people starting to marry slightly later than they had been getting married previously. Public education in the 1940s and 50s continues to expand. Literacy rates across the board go up. Overall education levels start to go up. And the high school diploma really does become the expectation. It's a big deal to celebrate your high school graduation. Because of that, universities and colleges begin to grow in popularity and influence. And this is really the effect of the greatest generation pouring into the education system at the time. Okay. One of my favorite little tidbits of trivia is that nickname, the greatest generation. Yes, it was given to themselves. Okay. That generation decided to name themselves the greatest generation. We could certainly have another episode where we talk about if that moniker is appropriate and makes sense or not. But for now, we'll go with it because it is a label that they gave themselves that stuck for a little while. All right. After World War II, 1950s, there's this big economic boom that starts to drive adolescent consumption and marketing. Not only is there an economic boom, there is also a baby boom. Okay. So this is when the baby boomers start to be born. And for a long time, they are the largest generation percentage-wise in the United States to that point. Okay. They become this big cultural and influential group because there's just so many of them. It's the first time in the 1950s and then leading into the 1960s where there are a group of teenagers who have a significant amount of free time because of public schooling and the approach to education, as well as expendable income because the economy is doing so well. Corporations start to advertise to teenagers and really create and glamorize the idea of youth culture. Okay. That glamorization of youth culture really never lets go. And actually, we're still kind of living into that all the way until today. If you've ever heard phrases like 20 is the new 30, 30 is the new 40, 40 is the new 50, you know what? Let's just keep going up. 70 is the new 80. Why not? This idea of glamorizing youth and having a youth-focused culture really never lets go after it is introduced when the baby boomers are in their teenage years. And from the 1960s onwards, adolescence kind of continues to expand, okay? There are specializations that corporations take on for youth consumption, and the developmental sciences continue to expand the definitions of adolescence and a continued expansion of education. There are parts of the United States and parts of the world where the high school diploma is not the expectation anymore. Now the expectation is an associate's degree, or the expectation is some kind of bachelor's degree, and you need to continue to try to go above and beyond in order to be recognized as an adult in the community or in the culture that you're living in, okay? Some of the things that I think are very, very interesting related to those dynamics are how they affect generations and how they interact with each other, okay? The idea of a youth-obsessed culture and a youth-focused culture really continued to grow through the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and we're kind of seeing the impacts of those things. One of the pieces also that's a little bit difficult about being in ministry with youth or being in ministry with young adults is that the definition of who an adolescent is continues to expand, okay? And by that, I mean the cultures that we're a part of sometimes have a difficult time identifying milestones for when somebody does make a transition from childhood into adolescence or from adolescence into adulthood. And some things that used to be used as very traditional markers for what it meant to be an adult, like graduating college, like getting married, like buying a house, like being financially independent, or maybe even like having a child of their own, those things do not happen in a linear order anymore, okay? The challenges that young people are facing related to inflation, to housing costs, to the accessibility of education, to the desire to get married or not be married, have children or not have children. None of those happen in a straight line like they did at times when there was sort of this more traditional monoculture, I guess, if is the right word to be able to say. So anyways, we've got young people trying to grow up and become adults in a culture that has a hard time recognizing when adulthood is reached, because anything can happen in any order. And so recognizing maturity becomes really, really difficult, or identifying when somebody is a full adult becomes very, very difficult. Some of the easier examples of that are, well, okay, if I'm a teenager and I'm trying to, you know, figure out my own identity, and I'd like to be presented as an adult to the culture that's around me. Okay, it's a big deal when you get your driver's license, right? Which usually happens at 15 or 16, unless you live in some states where you can get earlier permits, right, for farm work and those kinds of things. You might have somebody who's driving as early as 14 or as early as 15. At 18, other things start to happen, right? Usually you graduate high school. If you really wanted to buy cigarettes or other things that are available for purchase at the age of 18, you can do so. You can also start to serve in the military at the age of 18. But culturally, ask yourself, do we look around and do we consider 18-year-olds often to be full adults in our communities? And I would argue the answer is usually probably not. Okay, after that, what, 21? 21, you can start to legally purchase alcohol in the United States. But there's still a few things out there, like, you know, you probably haven't graduated from college yet. And so there's this cultural understanding that you may not be a full adult just yet. You might be considered a young adult, but you still get that label put on you. And then really, I mean, as best as I can figure after that, the next big one is being able to rent a car without having to pay extra at the age of 25, which isn't nearly as exciting, but who knows, that may be one of the final markers of adulthood that we could actually point to from a corporate or governmental kind of idea. Within churches, and this will be my last thought for today's episode of the Youth Worker Recharge, within the church, I think we equally struggle sometimes with being able to identify spiritual, mature individuals and to celebrate people as they grow in their maturity as disciples, okay? As I think about some of the very broad traditional things that get done in Protestant denominations or in United Methodist, the United Methodist denomination in particular, would be something like there's this celebration around third grade Bibles, right? That our churches pour a lot of energy into being able to get the names of folks who are in third grade and giving them that third grade gift Bible and inviting them in to be able to kind of read the word and be involved in a new way once they get their very own Bible from the church for the first time. And then after that, maybe it's confirmation. There's not really a standard age that that happens at in the United Methodist Church. It could be anywhere really between sixth grade all the way up through eighth, ninth, 10th, 11th, 12th grade if you're going to be a part of a confirmation class at United Methodist Church. But even if somebody has gotten their third grade Bible and has gone through confirmation class and takes all the membership vows to become part of a United Methodist Church, again, look at yourself as a leader, look at the community that you're a part of, look at the church that you're a part of, and ask yourself, does our church recognize the young people who completed confirmation as adults in our context or as spiritually mature in our context? And I'm, again, going to argue the answer is, well, probably not, right? There's going to be some other things that your church is going to ask young people to do in order for them to be seen as spiritually mature or in order for them to be seen as adults in your context. Obviously, I think we celebrate high school graduations. I think we celebrate college graduations and all those kinds of things as well. But just as murky as it is for a teenager to emerge from the label of an adolescent in the broader culture, it's equally as difficult for them to be able to emerge from that label of a youth or a young adult and be seen as a spiritually mature member of the church where they worship and where they pray and where they're part of small groups and where they study and learn and serve. So my encouragement, again, last thought, is for you as a church leader to be able to look for opportunities to recognize spiritual maturity in your context. Celebrate that along with young people and celebrate it alongside your whole faith community. When you have somebody who has a faith formation story that makes a difference in their lives or is starting to make discernment around their vocation or figuring out new ways that they can serve the church and really plug in as leaders. It's also incumbent upon you to offer leadership opportunities for young people. One of the best ways to learn is by practicing. And the best way to grow into a mature faith is to have mentors and friends that surround you and make opportunities for you to be able to grow and learn and serve as you go. Practicing your faith, being able to reflect back on it, and growing into a more mature disciple because of the experiences that you've had. It's a beautiful pattern of discipleship. I hope that can be a part of what your church's approach to ministry with young people can be. All right. Anyway, I feel like I've talked a ton. It's a little funny when I'm by myself. Please join us next Monday for our next Youth Worker Recharge. I hope you found this particular one meaningful, insightful as we looked at the brief, brief history of adolescence. It's always a joy to hang out with you a little bit on Mondays. And my prayer for you in the coming week is that you have the opportunity to feel God's presence in everything that you do, whether that is at home, at work, at church, out in the community, wherever you may be. God's there. And I pray that you have opportunities to sense God's presence in your life. Thank you for joining us. You can always look for old episodes of the Youth Worker Recharge set up as an audio podcast at umcyoungpeople.org, along with a whole lot of other resources that we offer. Thanks again.
See you next week.